at Segundo. This week, no lengthy intro, no vacation, no shoulder to cry on. We're starting to think outside the box. Our young roving correspondent talked with Jay Ryan. He is a man who lives in Chicago and has printed a lot of silkscreen posters for bands I can't keep track of. Shellac, Fugazi, the Decemberists, but no Perry Como. Well, it's just as well. Anyway, Mr. Ryan has a book out called 100 Posters, 134 Squirrels, and frankly, I'm a bit disappointed. I flipped through the book very carefully, and I counted only 84 squirrels. I feel as if I've been robbed. Of course, if I were out in the field talking with our subjects, I'd get to the bottom of these very important issues, but they hire me to announce these introductions. I guess I'm past my prime. Anyway, our young roving correspondent talked with Ryan and confused squirrels with hamsters, but no matter, here is their conversation.
I am here with Poster Man and Jay Ryan. Jay, how are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks, Ed.
Well, first of all, I wanted to kind of get a sense of how these posters kind of come into being. What's the associative process in your mind? What's that like?
Well, thankfully, most of the time I get to work for bands that I'm friends with or a fan of their music, so I'm familiar with what's appropriate, kind of, or at least have some idea of kind of the aesthetic of the band and what kind of things they like, hopefully, or at least my interpretation of that. So I guess I usually think about what's like being able to take a tangent from an element of the record cover art or a theme that runs through a lot of the band's music, or maybe illustrate specifically a song, and in a way that maybe only people who listen to the band would say, oh, well, that's, you know, well, that poster obviously has to do with Sleater-Kinney's song Jumpers, or that song obviously has to do with the Decemberists' Red Right Ankle, or something like that.
But also you have, like, for example, the three astronauts going and being attacked by hamsters, things like that, which aren't necessarily explicit references, but I mean, you know.
Well, that's kind of a take off of, that poster actually has an okay story. This is a poster for Shellac, who's a band from Chicago. They were playing three shows in San Francisco in 98, and up to this point, they'd been working on a record called Terraform, and Terraform's record cover was pictures of astronauts colonizing other planets. And so I'd done a number of posters for them that had astronauts doing kind of other things as they colonized the planets, like doing their laundry and playing baseball, basically.
Yeah.
So I said, they said, well, we're doing this West Coast tour. And I said, okay, well, should we do some more astronauts? And they said, yeah, that's fine. Although, you know, to tell you the truth, we did just finish writing this song about squirrels. And I had not heard the song, but this he described how it was kind of sort of a little, the song was kind of a sort of a reference to the to Herzog's Aguirre, Wrath of God, and the scene at the end where there's a all these monkeys on the raft, and maybe that was a different conversation, but the point was we were talking about a ton of squirrels, and we were also talking about astronauts, so the poster ended up coming out with the three astronauts representing, I guess, the three guys in the band, kind of tucked in the corner of the poster, being swarmed by hundreds of cute little squirrels running towards them, and I guess one of the things is if you actually look at the poster up close, you see that the squirrels are running up and actually just kind of hugging them. They're not actually
really
tackling or killing them. You kind of get the impression that they're. I had somebody describe it to me last week as the one with the astronauts killing all those squirrels. But if you look at it, it's really just the squirrels are just kind of running up and hugging them.
there's this one too here, the baseball and the hearts.
Right,
as well.
It's a sort of a similar situation. One astronaut being, it's a Valentine's Day show in Chicago, and so this astronaut's being surrounded by these floating disembodied hearts that are shooting electricity at him, and he's warding them off the baseball bat.
I'm trying to find the particulars.
There it is.
Oh, there we go.
So if you look close, you see that they're actually just
You're right. They're just actually the squirrels.
They're kind of clinging to them and hugging them and not really being mean-spirited at all.
Okay, wow. That's very interesting. So it works on multiple levels here.
Hopefully.
Yes. The other thing that's interesting about this is your typography. Like, for example, this. It's very, very... What do you do to sort of get a look like, for example, this, which is extremely...
I had this kind of early... Well, let's start back further.
Okay.
In high school, I studied... I was studying architecture, thinking that I was going to study architecture in college. And so I got really good at kind of that traditional architectural handwriting style. And I think my phone's ringing. So that I kind of came up, I had just kind of naturally this sort of interesting clean cut handwriting, and then once I started making posters after I was out of, well, I point was I didn't end up with an architecture degree, with a painting degree out of school, and when I started making posters after I was out of college, so about half the time I would do the posters with hand-drawn type, and about half the time with type that I'd output from the computer and just kind of cut into place. And it was pointed out to me that the hand-drawn type was much more interesting than the computer type. So I cut out the computer type entirely and stuck with a hand-drawn type. So in that poster you're just pointing out was for another poster, coincidentally, for Shellac, doing a tour of the South and the Midwest. And the handwriting it almost becomes like a texture in the background behind the image. It's a picture of a Lomo microphone, there's texture, like technical details about the microphone behind the, kind of in the background, reversed out of behind the microphone as texture.
Now, have you ever had any sort of issues because when someone comes to you and says, "Hey, Jay, we need you to go ahead and run with the concept," do you have any sort of restrictions, or does a client perhaps come to you and say, "This is not what we wanted," or what's the deal with this? Or are you in such demand that this is not an issue at all? Or you're relatively free and liberated?
I've been doing this too long, and I'm too grumpy to be really a lot of fun to work with. I think for some people, it's like I said, I do get to work a lot most of the time for bands that I'm familiar with, and they know what to expect. So from me, so I can I've had pretty few cases where I think the band was really unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe a lot of times it's not what they expect, but they realize that I'm drawing from the point of view of a fan and what I. Maybe I see what I see in their music or in their general MO. Anyway, I don't charge enough to I don't charge bands enough to justify having them complain about anything really. So if they'd like to pay more, which I charge more corporate jobs, then they can have more of a say in the creative process. But on the other hand, there's, you know, I'm a poster maker, and so you hire me to make the poster in the same way that I wouldn't ask the band to change the way they play a song. I think most of the people that I work with, I think, kind of understand that without me having to say anything about that.
Interesting sights that you're picking up.
Yeah, no, I'm just sitting. We're sitting in a coffee shop and watching the people walk by and walking.
More objects and people to ferment in your head for future posters.
Yeah. Well, we were just talking a minute ago about the bread cutter, a bread slicer behind the counter, and now I have this image of the bread slicer cutting up posters, and I'm kind of kind of have a number of things milling around in my head now.
I was curious. You moved obviously when things got, you know, sort of, you were in more demand. You moved, I read, from straight silkscreen process to a mechanical press. I was wondering if this had an influence upon the artistic direction.
Well, no, it's actually the exact same process. It's just a matter of the fact that we got to the point, I have a guy named Matt Daly who works with me, a friend of mine, and he does most of the printing. He probably does 80 or 90% of the actual printing at this point. And where I printed all of my stuff first number of years that I was making posters, then it made sense to hire somebody to help me pull the prints.
Yeah.
We still do exactly the same process, except now we have a machine that pulls the squeegee. Everything else is still the same, the making the screens, registering the paper. It's all done the same.
And all that too,
I'm sorry?
Does this affect like the smudge parts or the imperfections?
No. It makes them actually slightly higher quality, but I don't think that really a normal... They make them slightly more regular, but there's still a lot of irregularity to them. And also, I don't think, like, somebody who's not really familiar with screen printing probably isn't going to notice some of the really minor differences. It just makes things... We got to the point about 2 years ago where both Matt and I were having major tendon issues and... I was constantly bleeding out of my fingertips, literally.
Wow.
Like, not, you know, from the pads of my fingers. And pulling prints is really tiring. And I'm... So, I guess working for, you know, 8 or 10 hours a day pulling prints by hand is one layer, one sort of exhaustion. Whereas if we run the machine, it's... physically a lot less exertion, so we've moved to running a semi-automatic press. Like I said, really the only thing it does is it pulls the squeegee. Everything else is still done by hand. So.
And I was trying to actually track down the original source, the End of the World poster from Rockwell, Kent.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I was trying to find the original picture for that, and I couldn't find it.
I was looking for it myself, and I finally... I didn't actually get it, but I had to find I saw a 1939 Life magazine that had Rockwell Kent lithographs depicting four possible scenarios for the end of the world. And one scenario was where the sun goes huge in the sky and scorches the earth, and the image is from eye level, and the sun is taking up the entire sky, and people are laying in piles and charred bones on the ground. And that's one scenario. The second one is the opposite, where the sun loses all its power and it's a tiny speck in the sky, and everybody's standing in the snow on hilltops dressed in parkas with their arms up into the air. I don't remember the third scenario, but the fourth illustration by Rockwell Kent was this beautiful lithograph of the situation where a rogue planet would come too close to the Earth and negate the Earth's gravity, and all the people and trees and furniture fly up into the sky, and so,
how close is this sort of visually?
Visually, it's my interpretation of that is not really the same at all. But I was hired to do a poster for a band called The New Year and a band called Silkworm, playing in three shows in Texas, and so that reversal of gravity is kind of touched on a lifelong irrational fear of mine, just of the reversal of gravity. Not like a serious thing, but
like this apocalyptic sort of thing? I have that myself.
Yeah, there's a name for that. I can't remember what it is, but there's
apocalyptic
a name.
Apocalypticphilia? I don't know.
No, it's a... Andrew Bird, actually, who I do a lot of work for, he knows the actual scientific term for somebody who's fascinated by the idea of the end of the world, which I think we all are to some degree, and that's why we keep going to see movies like...
I've seen
that weather movie from last year.
The Perfect Storm, or the day after tomorrow.
And or whether it's, you know, or whatever, where the aliens invade and kill everybody, or whatever.
If
Terminator.
You're familiar with like DEFCON 4 or Testament or even Chud, then you know chances are you have this affliction.
Yeah, or even you know more mainstream like the War of the Worlds or Terminator or something like that. Anyway, this scenario is more natural in this poster. We've got. Looks like the moon maybe coming really close to the Earth, and it's kind of a diagram of all the things that are going up off the surface of the Earth and into the sky. We've got like an elephant and some tables and a bathtub and a house and a bunch of cars, and then there's a whale. And then way over in the right corner, there's a gorilla holding a snake right over here.
Uh-huh.
It's like a silverback gorilla clinging to what looks like a cobra. It's very small, just very small details.
Wow.
But the move to doing book covers has been a nice surprise of the last couple of years. Michael Chabon wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and then his next publication was going to be this, turning one of his short stories into a novella. This had been published previously in the Paris Review, but it's just like a 100-page story, The Final Solution. And the story that I was told was that he was, the author was in his editor's office, and she had my Flaming Lips and Hum poster from New Year's Eve 2000 up on her wall. And he said, you know, we should get that guy.
Wow.
So that's what I was told anyway. So anyway, they contacted me and said, would you like to do this cover for Michael Chabon? And I just finished reading Cavalier and Clay at that point, and I was very excited about it. And it turned out, after lots of revisions and going back and forth, I think it turned out pretty well. I was very happy with it. The image is of a African gray parrot who's kind of infused with all these numbers. He's a character in the book. His name's Bruno. And Bruno, one of his main kind of functions in the plot is that he's constantly spouting a string of numbers in German. And that leads to all sorts of stuff.
So. Now, was this was your first book cover, or did you do any before this?
This is my first book cover of that scale, okay. I think. And like for a major publisher. And since then, I just finished another one, actually, for the same publisher, for an author named Brian Charles, who has a novel called Grab Onto Me Tightly As If I Knew the Way, which is a reference to a Pavement lyric.
Okay.
From the band Pavement. So anyway, that'll be out sometime this spring.
Okay. So. Now, I'm curious if some of these additional sort of, you know, exercises, I mean, does constantly doing sort of rock posters get boring after a while? Do you feel the need to sort of channel your, you know, creative energies elsewhere? Or how do you cope with this?
Well, I feel like, I mean, every project that I work on is different. You know, doing something for doing something for the band Low is very different from doing something for the band The Melvins.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I approach them the same way, but the solution is always, you know, ends up being different.
Sure.
Actually, to think about it, the posters I've done for Low and the Melvins actually aren't that different at all. Sometimes people ask do I do my own work? Do I do paintings or something on the side that serves me? But really, I feel like everything that I get to do working for these bands is my own work, because I'm not art directed very heavily on 90% of the stuff. 90% of the illustrations, maybe 95-98%, there's really nobody's input on them except for my own. So sometimes the band will say, hey, we'd like you to make a poster, but they'll give me something like, could it have a car, or you know, it's a Halloween show, or we're playing at a winter festival. And so I'll try to do, okay, winter, and that's like a pretty broad theme, and I can definitely work inside of that. So we've got some kind of ridiculous snowman creature or Santa doing something, terrorizing a small child in a field, or a bunch of people on bikes in a snowstorm or something. I don't know.
Gotcha.
But that's, you know, I have no problem at all, like, working within a small, like, a really wide, I guess a real wide playing field like that. I wish I was clever enough to really plan a lot of subtexts, but I generally don't, only because I guess I don't think about things that much as I'm working on them. But at the same time, I think that you don't have to be blatant about a message, or at least I don't have to be blatant about a message when I'm dealing with working for a band. I think the more unintentionally oblique, maybe is a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Maybe unintentionally oblique or subtle that you are. I think the more that people appreciate being able to see the elements. Okay, well, it's a truck. It's got fruit on the side of the truck. It's a truck, so it's got something in it, and it says food you drink. Okay, well, I can figure that out if we're talking specifically about this truck. Or, if, okay, it's a poster, so it's obviously advertising something. It's got a picture of... It's got a picture of a hunting knife and a bottle of beer that's empty, and it says Guided by Voices. So I know Guided by Voices. They're that band that drinks a lot and has the poster, or has a song about one of their most favorite popular songs is My Valuable Hunting Knife. And that's not a very good example, I guess, now that I think about it.
But
that's kind of spelling it out. But
what we're talking about, though, also is that for someone who isn't familiar with Guided by Voices, most hardcore music geeks are, but someone who wants to go see a show will see a poster of yours and go, "What is this?" Or "What are these three astronauts with the squirrels?" They'll want to know, or with a Fugazi poster of the folding chairs. These are things that like kind of. Yes, there is a specific sort of association we're talking about here, but at the same time, you're also planting a seed for discovery, I think.
I think also, that's true. Somebody sees the chairs, the Fugazi poster, the whole, a grid, each square filled in with a folding chair, and like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
I to be honest, I don't know specifically where that came from. I don't remember at this point, but then they go and they can open up... Fugazi's album Steady Diet of Nothing and see that there's a room full of folding chairs in the photo in the middle of that album from 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Or they can see...
Jesus, 15 years ago. Mark.
Well, what is that, like 90, 91 or 92, I think?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Okay, we'll say 14 years ago and then we won't feel so old. Wow, this guy's got a nice jacket on.
Yeah. And his posture is
really,
pretty good,
really
too.
Well put together. Yeah. He's waving at the cute girls over there. Guy had a teal velvet sport coat on that was really well fit to him.
And it was also his posture and the way he walked.
And he was extremely...
His gait was like his back was very upright.
Yeah,
and,
And
very little arm
head.
Motion.
Yeah.
Yes.
very well put together. Anyway, he was waving at this gang of... young women who just returned from shopping, it looks like, across the street.
Yeah.
And, let's see, what else?
Planting a seed is what we were kind of
talking
about.
Oh, yeah, so we were talking about planting a seed, and we can talk about, then somebody goes on and listens more to Fugazi, and they realize that they have a song called Furniture, and they've got another song called Waiting Room, and I guess it's not... That's... a little more subtle and a little bit more of a reach, but
it's not as oblique necessarily as the. I don't think the folding chairs is as oblique as the three astronauts, which is a very sort of comparatively obscure.
well, that's in one sense, yes, because there aren't necessarily songs about astronauts, but on the other hand, there's one of Shellac's record covers, and the whole cover is photos of paintings of astronauts, so. That's a little more direct, but...
One last question, then.
Okay,
Basically, to try to tie this all in together.
Yeah.
Okay. So we set up a couple of things. First of all, handcrafted versus machine, explicit versus oblique. How do these two dichotomies, so to speak, or the gray areas within those the two spectrums we're talking about here, how do they fit in with you as an artist when you go ahead and... I mean, is there, in the use of color, or in the use of typography, or in the use of sort of like getting a concept sort of fleshed out to a poster, do you think obliqueness is possible in a machine-based environment, or do you think
I think so, certainly. I have this particular set of tools that I use, which are different from, which are antiquated relative to... a lot of the tools that are used today. There are no computers used in my design process. The printing is done essentially by hand, and that's different from creating a file in Photoshop or Illustrator and then pressing print and having it come out of your inkjet printer, or your laser printer. I have to take the medium into consideration in the design process. So I take I think about I'm working within some strict limitations. It's kind of like just having a box of 24 crayons, you know. So you know you're not going to get the gold crayon, and you know you're not going to get the silver crayon, but you've got, you know, seafoam green and grass green, and so this is kind of the palette you've got to work with. I know that I can't do insanely tight registration with incredibly tight details. I can't do very, very small type. I can't work larger than roughly 20 by 24 inches or something like that. I can only print on flat surfaces. I can't, you know, it's hard for me to make things glossy, but you know, within that field, you know, technical and aesthetic limitations, I think that, you know, it's a matter of, you know, learning to use what you've got pretty well, hopefully. One of the reasons I think that we have a lot of bad design in some places today, these days, is that you've got a really great tool in something like Adobe's Photoshop program, where everybody has access to all these wonderful tools. And the problem is that everybody uses all these tools. And so instead of, I guess, you've got an image, well, we can put some lens flare there, so let's put some lens flare. And we can do this and that and use 42 different typefaces, so let's do that. And I think that generally can create a mess. So and I think that's what we see a lot of times. Especially, I love seeing terrible, I love in the way that makes me wince, love seeing just like terrible, terrible websites where there's like the coding is bad and it's on a black background and all the
those
text
GeoCities,
is
type all sorts of
terrible things. Yeah. Anyway, that's just funny to me, but you know, but for every one of those, well, for every 24 of those, there's somebody who really knows how to use some restraint and say, use this tool to do something amazing, but not do everything amazing.
Yeah. So you've consciously resisted this restraint, essentially. I mean, you've consciously resisted, like, you are a person who requires limitations and restraint in order to actually accomplish your work, you feel?
I don't think that it's that I require them as much as that's just naturally the world that I'm working in. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I design things, draw things with pencil and or pen. The different colors on the poster, the separations, are all cut from films with an X-Acto knife. Those films are made into screens, and the screens are printed with water-based ink. And so those are my parameters, and I think I've done a pretty good job of learning to work within those parameters. So, and then you just learn now and again how to, you know, push in one direction or another, whether it's printing larger than you thought you could or doing something crazy with a pencil and making the films that you didn't think was possible. So, and I think that's where interesting things happen and also where interesting things fail to happen sometimes.
Gotcha.
So, I don't know if that's much of an answer, but that's,
well, it kinda,
that's
kinda
what
gets,
I've got.
It gets us there.
So
we'll leave a little bit of a bleakness ourselves for the listeners so that they can actually go straight to your work and find a lot of these sort of secrets of your dog, apparently. Jay Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ed. My time to want to sell a trade.